from the Sky News Centre at 5. There was a gross failure in the treatment of a 15-year-old girl who died of undiagnosed tuberculosis despite nearly 30 hospital and GP appointments. That's the ruling of a coroner who says neglect played a role in the death of Alina Sarag in Birmingham. The inquest found neglect contributed. Hedab Sultan is furious.
All the way through all of this, all we've been told is lies upon lies upon lies. All the health organisations, everything just doesn't tell you like what they're supposed to be telling you.
A soldier from 1st Battalion, the Royal Anglian Regiment, has been killed in Helmand Province in Afghanistan, his family has been told. A family friend of Shafilia Ahmed told a court how the teenager's sister confided in him that their dad had stabbed her. The 17-year-old's parents, Iftikhar and Farzana Ahmed, deny suffocating her and dumping the body in Cumbria. City experts are warning there's no guarantee that a multi-million pound government banking scheme will kickstart lending. The Bank of England and the Treasury are pumping around £80 billion into banks to be offered as cheap loans. The average household income has fallen by over 7% in for 3 years to 2011. A report by the Institute for Fiscal Studies found it was down to rising inflation and unemployment. That's the latest. I'm Kat Collins.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is UKIP councillor for Woodlands Ward in Bradley Stoke. That's Ed Rose. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the McNulty report into the railways is recommending that the privatised train operating companies should be able to charge what they want, meaning fares will go even higher. Well, that's good news for the oil companies, but what will it mean for the rest of us? Big changes being mooted to fishing rights also around the villages of the southwest coast. We hear from Wilf Mound from Bristol Greenpeace. Plus, review of the weekend before last, Bilderberg NATO secret government conference. The BBC didn't tell you that it was even going on because their man was inside and sworn to secrecy. Plus, Martin Summers' usual roundup of world events in the second hour after the news at 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, some light rain and gusty winds. This weekend, that's highs of 16 Celsius, generally wet and windy this weekend with some particularly heavy rain, possibly on Sunday evening. Next week, highs of 21 and plenty of sunny spells this week and a few showers. Next weekend, that's the 23rd and 24th of June, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. Now, first though, the Lopresti report, and Freemasonic Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, said on this show back on Friday the 13th of March that he would give me a copy of the 2012 Bristol Provincial Yearbook, as the Freemasons have nothing to hide. This lists the membership of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in roughly 50 lodges. Jack also said he would arrange a guided tour of the Masonic Hall at 31 Park Street. Well, 4 weeks on, and I've sent two follow-up letters but had no replies, and still no Bristol Provincial Yearbook or tour. Rather like talking to a brick wall. But Jack did call to inform me that there is an open day at the Bristol Masonic Temples behind the Council House tomorrow, that is Saturday the 16th of June, where you can see Bristol's Freemasons and possibly tour the temples for yourself. Also, if anyone listening has access to the latest or a recent Bristol Provincial Yearbook, I'd very much appreciate a look at it. Probably best not to entrust it to the post or a third party, just email me or phone and I'll come and pick it up. So, on to the business of the day, and helping us to review this week's news is UKIP councillor for Woodlands in Bradley Stoke, Ed Rose. Hi Ed, welcome to Drive Time.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, my pleasure to be here.
Now, Ed, there is a reason why you've defected to UKIP, I imagine, from the Conservatives. Can you tell us what made you take what is fairly drastic step? Because people have elected you as a Conservative.
Yes, that's right. They elected me as a Conservative standing at that time. I think really what people elect you for is someone that can get in and do the job and represent the people properly. The move to UKIP, I don't see it as a defection at all. I see it as making the right move for the right reasons. the representation of the community, the representation by politics has to have that aspect of integrity. My move from the Conservatives was for the fact that the aspects of what we would call gentlemanly behaviour, proper manners and integrity was completely lacking in the Conservative Party, and no measure of reform, redress or pull your socks up was being done by anybody there. And so I just decided to say, well, I'll seek a better opportunity with people that have that, and UKIP provide that.
Now, I mean, surely this sounds a bit maybe like sour grapes, because every party has got people of all sorts of different perspectives, different points of view. Okay, so, you know, they're generally, you know, different from one another to a certain extent. But, I mean, why is it that you can't accept that certain people in your party have got different views to you in the old Conservative Party?
Very interesting the way that you proposed that. You said there are different people with different views. We would like to have that, surely. But when you're in the Conservative Party, you're being different and having different views is not allowed. You're not allowed to have a view. What you're only allowed to do is follow party policy. And if you don't follow party policy, somehow, somewhere, someone will have a word in your ear or ring you up at an awkward time and give you a bit of a roasting. I'm not the type of person to take that from anybody, and I won't stand for it. I say that I'm entitled to my view and opinion. I make sure it's an educated opinion to back it up and why I can have that. Politics is meant to be the art of controversy, and the art of controversy is that you become educated about it so you know you're not talking rubbish. The Conservatives do not allow that in the party. It was simply, that's the line, if you cross it, we'll ostracise you. And that's been their behaviour.
And is that just, do you think, this one particular branch of the Conservative Party in South Gloucestershire, or what's going on here?
I have to be careful with that answer, because I don't have contact with Conservatives at a wider field, but certainly the Conservatives in the South Gloucestershire area and the local MP has exercised that behaviour on more than one occasion.
But I mean, hang on, you're in a democratic party. Surely if the party decides something, then you have to stick to that, otherwise what you're doing is you're being a bit of a troublemaker.
Call it a rebel. I want to get straight to the point and put it with a capital R. I think that you should look at something and say, well, let's discuss and understand why you're making that statement. The example was when we came up last year for the vote to have a possible change in the way that we do our referendums. The Conservatives had the line that you just tell people, no, we don't want it. And I said, well, hang on a minute. The way you should do this as a government, a reigning government, is that you educate the people so they then make a informed choice as to yes or no. To go along and just turn around and say, all you're going to say to people is, we the government, the Conservative government, we're the leaders, tell you the public it's no, and I'm not going to give you the information so you can make a choice, smacks rather of previous governments in other countries that went down very dangerous pathways.
But isn't it a bit of a different balance to make between having a policy which is right across the party and having everybody with different ideas and different policies, effectively? I mean, surely, if it's going to be one party, there's got to be one policy.
Okay, well then, could you go put on your uniform and your jack boots and see you marching down the street and sig hail to you? Because that's the very same argument that was done in the 1930s in other countries, even this country. Oswald Mosley, looked at that line of saying,
father of Max Mosley of Formula One fame.
Max Mosley, indeed. And if you take a look at what was said in those days by the Italians, by the Germans, by elements in this country, which was quite frightening, that was the very line argument of, well, we'll have a party, we've made our choices, we'll push it through.
But was there one particular moment where you thought, I just can't stand this anymore, I can't take it anymore? Imagine, you know, this is something that builds up over a little while, and at some point you think, look, I've just had enough of this.
The point of having enough of this is where you realise that you cannot make a difference anymore. And the part of it you can't make a difference anymore in my locality was the aspects of smear campaign that was going on. I was caught up in that as well. What was disgusting about this was that the echelon of the Conservatives knew where this was coming from, knew it was wrong, and did absolutely nothing about it. Now, normally, you know, when you're older and you're sage and something's going on that's pretty bad, you might not rat the person out or the people out that are doing it, but you go have a word and you say, this is totally wrong, stop it.
So what you're saying is effectively that there was no point in you staying in the party because it was impossible to actually get the dirty linen dealt with privately. I mean, this is how any good organisation would deal with things. It wouldn't do it in the public sphere. It would say, well, okay, well, let's just, you've got a grievance there, let's go through a private process and make sure everybody's happy and that if someone needs to be disciplined, they are.
Well, it's a question of an understanding. What you do is you go and talk about it. But where you have a directive that says that's it, there's no talking about it, there's no comeback in that manner, and if someone's making a statement about somebody else in the way that you've behaved or not behaved or something that's questionable, there are already mechanisms in place to go to and say, well, that needs to be dealt with, which indeed is outside the public eye first of all. But that wasn't done. It was done in a very underhand, nasty way, and it was persistent. When it came to me and my aspect, I replied back and said, well, A, I've got a pretty good idea of who you are and I'm going to call you on it. Two, when you start throwing mud at more than one person, that you're just being spiteful. And why are you being spiteful? If you've got something to say, go to a committee meeting or go to a council meeting or go to the educator in South Gloss Council and make the statement as it should be done in a proper manner. And again, back to the point of what I said before, the Conservative Party knew this was going on. If they didn't at first, they knew about it later and didn't do anything about it. And that was the crucial point for me, was that if you don't stand up and rub out that kind of behaviour, where do you go next? What else is going on?
Okay, well, let's talk about some specific issues, though. So where did you and the Conservatives, other than this referendum thing you were talking about, locally, Park Company, where were there all differences of opinion, which could have just been allowed to run as differences of opinion, but you felt that that there was, you know, some bullying, at least of something like that, going on in order to try and get you to just simply toe the line and ignore your own conscience?
Well, there's certainly elements of bullying in there. We could talk about that at length for a long, long time. I think what it is that my feeling was, I am not serving the public in my elected role properly. It's not been effective, and I've got to get away from that. What can I do? Do I either stand as an independent, or is there something else I can do? And UKIP provided the line. I met with Nigel Farage, I met with Paul Nuttall, I've met with William Dartmouth. They are gentlemen that you can actually ask, like the radio show, the hard questions. They don't run away, they don't fluff their lines about it, and they say, that's a good question, this is the way we're looking at it, this is the way we want to work. And it's back to that bit that you feel you're dealing with people that you can work with. And the nice thing about that is, when you deal with people that you work with, that you are allowed to have a difference of opinion. So the fact is, there may be a party line that you say, well, I'm not quite so happy about that, that won't be the way I would do it, but at least you'll have the understanding and the full picture as to why, rather than just being whip-handed backwards to say, just toe the line.
Okay, but I want to pin you down on some of the issues where you parted company from the Conservative Party officially, where you are, because I'm sure there are other Conservatives in Bradley Stoke that feel like you do, rather than the party. Well, so what are the issues? What's the main issue?
The main issue is, I don't think they care. I think quite happily the Conservatives have their manifest destiny, let's put it that way, and that's all they worry about. As to the well-being of society, they don't.
At the local now, what level, about Filton Airfield?
Well, let's get to that in the part of the answer. In general, overall well-being of the constituencies that there are, it's hard to see their understanding of what's going on. Their handling of finance has been pretty disgusting at a higher level. Cameron at that level spoke to the Institute of Bankers at a dinner and said, my great-grandfather's a banker, my grandfather's a banker, my father was an investment banker, I will never hurt bankers, quote unquote. Now, when you start making statements that are going to give a get-out-of-jail-free to bankers who are already admonished for behaving with criminal intent, because these guys knew exactly what they were doing in that aspect. If I was to put a legal hat on and have Her Majesty the Queen in presence, I would actually be calling for a treason law to be enacted and brought into effect and say, you've acted against the state, You've acted against the well-being of this country. You've put your commercial needs first, and you really have brought detriment to this country. We're in a double-dip recession, and the Conservatives are hands in pocket in that, and they know about it, and they haven't done anything with it. Let's take another look at some of the things that they do. They made promises about NHS, and we're not going to touch it, yet they have. So I look at it from the point of view is that you have a society, you have a certain level that you expect and well-being, and when you start taking it away from people, you think, well, what's left? What is there in our country today? I joined politics because I wanted to make a difference at a local level. I wanted to be able to take my skills and experience that help people understand what local government's about for local people by that. And working in town council, working in South Gloss, I see it does work. Being chair of the South Gloss Safer Stronger Committee, I meet with people of the public, listen to what is actually going on, and get a chance to actually get involved and do things, you know, at a personal level, and also at a distant level, whereby I go back to the actual main offices of the town council, or indeed to Gloucestershire Council, and say, okay, here's the issues that have been raised, how do we deal with them, how do we get the information to the people so they know exactly what's going on. For example, street lighting. There was a huge case about street lighting, people getting upset about it, the MP just didn't want to know about it.
What was this, shutting off the street lighting late at night?
Shutting off street lighting. Well, what came out that was interesting on that part was the legality of it is that the council or councils around the United Kingdom have no remit to actually provide street lighting. It's discretionary entirely, which was kind of interesting to come out. And I was trying to quote on there, well, the human rights for safety. If you've got street lights and you have lighting, there's an element of safety you have, which, funny enough, goes against the police reports. The police reports come out and say, well, when you don't have street lights, youth and criminals don't like it when it's dark, so they don't go and commit a crime. Well, I think that's something that's strange.
No, we had the case in Clevedon, didn't we, just before Christmas, where there was a soldier walking down just after they switched off the street lights at 1 a.m. He was walking down back from the pub and got knocked over and killed just because there's no street lights.
The street lights. Again, it's back to common sense where you are. I can understand where you may have a street that has a straight line and has many, many lights, and you may turn off two or three as it staggers. It still gives enough ambient light for that to be safe. But where you go turn off a whole block, that it's almost like a blackout. Well, what's the problem of turning one on or two? This is the issue that highlights the inability to come along and look at local level of what's operational, what can be done. It's just brushed away. It's not important enough. We don't want to know about it.
But what about Filton? Because I know this is a massive issue around your part of the world. There's a lot of people I've spoken to off the record, people who are working, for example, at GKN, engineers and people like that, who are absolutely convinced that once the airfield closes, that Airbus will move and other people will move out away from the area, and basically will just be flattened and covered with housing. And this is people who have seen that happen already up in Filton over the years.
It's a worry. What was worrying about it, the core strategy meeting that the council pulled, elements of truth came up. The unions were making statements that the backhanded deals were going on, that bullying was being done by BA to the other companies that say, well, if you do make any noise about the future of this, we'll take away contracts from you, we won't pay you, it's extremely difficult for you. And in other cases of some other companies, they turn and say, we'll refuse your landing rights and use of the airfield. Well, that's pretty disgusting, really, when you get to that part.
Well, it's also the fact that over the years, the contracts that have been awarded for people that want to stay there have been shorter and shorter. So, of course, for any really large company, they're not interested in looking at a one-year or a six-month contract to be allowed to stay there. They need a five-year contract, and BAE haven't been offering those long contracts.
It does push a way of containment, of preventing growth, preventing the future. And the thing with the Filton Airfield is that when you take a look at it from the base of history, it serves not only Filton, it serves the great area of Bristol. It has been a huge employment draw from around the world. You've had people come from all over the world to work at Filton, to work on aircraft design, aircraft manufacture, for decades and decades and decades. So it has that connectivity. It also has the capability that with MOD, that it could have been running the UAV program, which, funny enough, the project team are based at Abbey Wood, that our MP claims he knew nothing about.
This is the drones, the dreaded drones.
Which is part of the drones, but it's also part of other aspects of unmanned aerial vehicles that they could have. You could actually have pilotless passenger drones that take you to London.
No thanks.
Well, it could be done. I mean, you know,
that's like saying get on a pilot on a driverless train. I'm sorry, I'm just not interested.
Oh, yeah. You go to Japan and you get it. There are those opportunities. And the thing is that you may say, oh well, okay, that's sort of pie in the sky. The aspect that's bad is that none of that was explored. It was just the de facto acceptance of taking what is Filton Airfield, BAE want to make a load of money out of it. Okay, the contract, original contract, wasn't written very well when they had it for £1 and it was given over to them to say, we'll make use of it. It should really have been fought and gone back to the public because it was given over in that way. That was the intent, but the lawyers got hold of it, you know, 70 years later and said, oh, well, we're going to twist the words of it. It's ours and we can do what we like. But let's take the sense of moving forward. Let's say we're looking at the aspect of Filton Airfield, what it is. The original commercial license that was being put forward for that was naysayed was because of traffic. People said, well, if you have an airfield, you have lots of traffic, it's going to be really bad for the area, we don't want it. Let's wind forward now, 13 years later, you're going to build 8,000 homes. And how many cars average is 2, so you're going to add an extra 16,000 cars, not per week or per month, but per day, trying to traverse the same roads now that are chock-a-block every morning. You get up early in the morning and try and drive down that way. It is fraught. You've got to give yourself an extra 30, 40 minutes to get across 2 roundabouts. If you put that housing there, you've got a density of housing. Okay, what's the support structure for that? Where are the extra cinemas? Where are the extra restaurants? Where are the extra small shops? That hasn't been thought of. Where's the open parkland for people to go play and enjoy? That hasn't been thought of. And then the second thing is, more importantly, if we go back to Jack Lopresti and his I welcome jobs and I welcome apprenticeships, is where are they? Out of the working population of Bradley Stoke, 27,000 original people. Bring it down to the working population, this is about 9,250 to 9,500 actually had jobs. Since July, 2,500 people out of the Bradley Stoke area have lost their employment. And there's been no replacement for them. That's a huge effect on the local community of what's going on, because as soon as that happens, everything starts to close up. People are saying I asked them at the community meetings, are you happy living in Bradley Stoke? I was meaning, are you happy with the way that we look after you? We got the parklands kept, the grass is cut, you've got the services. And the answer came back was, I'm not happy, my neighbour hasn't moved, his kids hasn't moved, they built an extension, they've now got 6 cars in the driveway when the house was only supposed to have 2. What does that mean? I can't get in my driveway, it's over parked, people are stressed, they're upset. So what we're seeing is now is a cramping where people are caught by several reasons. No jobs, no money. No economy, no future. You've got a vicious circle going on here. You come back and you're going to build 8,000 homes, which has a part EU directive that's telling you how many people that you are going to put in there. Takes no view of what the situation is currently. So all you're doing is compounding it. And the fact is, if you're a town council or even a Gloucester council, you take a look at it and say, okay, if these people don't have money and the majority of them are going to go on the dole because there isn't the work, I'm not going to get the money from them. How can I service them? Let's take a look in America. Let's step to America and take a look where a depression hit. Let's take a lovely city, the city of Detroit. I've been there, I've visited there. You drive down some of those streets and it's like a view at a RoboCop. It's wasteland. And the wasteland is done because the municipal city, looking at it, turned around and said, mass unemployment, I'm not getting the tax money in, I'm not getting the services to you, I force evict people out because basically I retract my areas of where I can provide ample services. What happens now, whereby your council has been told by government, I've slashed this amount of money, and you have to slash this amount off your frontline services and back services? We're already seeing our libraries go, because that's an educational piece that people can get to, can use. They've always been a significant part of daily life. That's being dropped off. You've got the aspect that people are complaining to me regularly when I walk around about poo bins, which is a funny thing to talk about, but people are worried that people walk their dogs, it goes in a bag that's left on the ground. Why aren't there enough bins? Why aren't there in anywhere else? Well, the issue is that you can put in extra poo bins, but somebody has to empty them, which means you have to employ somebody that goes round to empty them. Council turns around and says, we're on serious cutbacks. I can't afford to employ more time or second position to go do that. So that, funny enough, highlights the interesting aspect of what a cut means. So people go around, their local area is being degraded by the fact that you now have poo that can't erode in a plastic bag because it's not open to the elements. So you have all these bags lying around, so somebody has to go along and shush them away somewhere later. Well, what usually happens, there's meadow brook and streams run there. Well, people are kicking them in the streams. So you've got a dirt and a hygiene aspect now that you're facing with. Well, you pull that up a bit further and say, well, if that's happening on a grander scale, people are throwing away rubbish and in that way because we can't get enough of that pulling in. There's a dangerous element growing underneath there that if you look and you can see when you pull the veneer off there of the services, you turn and say, well, what's it going to be like in a year's time? We're worried now about the well-being of the community, and that's why I try and fight so hard through the Safer, Stronger Community, and indeed through the MP himself. I've invited him, even forced myself through one of his meetings to go in and say, I want you to turn up and present yourself. I don't care that you're a Conservative, you're an MP, so you're a representative of government, so people can see you and come and get their issues heard and hopefully addressed. I'm just told that he's too busy in London with everything else. So that was another key point back to it, why I just felt the Conservatives don't care. We're having a whale of a time, thank you very much. And to coin a phrase, I'm all right, Jack. And there you go. I want to continue to make a difference. I want to be able to feel that I am happy of a job well done being a councillor. And indeed, I'm looking to improve the political reach of what I can do, because I think if you actually have the wherewithal, you can make a bigger difference.
Well, one of the things you seem to be implying there is that at least some of the existing Conservatives, I mean, particularly Jack Lopresti, is somebody that is not really taking a long-term view, that they realise that in a few years' time they won't have to pick up the tab, or they won't be responsible for the policies which are being implemented at the moment. And so that there's a sort of abrogation of responsibility. Now, don't you think that's just a general problem in politics?
No, I don't think that's a general problem in politics. I think it is the problem in politics. There's this part that there's the gravy train, I can get in, I can behave how I like. If anyone makes a complaint, I wanted to make a complaint or raise an issue, let's put it that way, the aspect of that goes right back to the very person you're complaining about. So all that happens is the secretary opens a letter, reads it, goes, oh my goodness me, and throws it in the bin. That's how that is worked. That is not the way to run to run your government. You need to have somebody there that says, if you're going to be an MP or if you're going to be an officer in this, you need to behave properly, you need to act properly, you need to do these things, we need to keep an eye on you that does it. You take a look at the MPs in the area that we have around Bristol, the Conservative MPs. They're different. They've got different web pages. They've got different aspects of what they do. If you move to South Bristol and you go to Leslie and you take a look at what she's doing, you can see through her website, she has a very nice map with pins in it, and it says, I've been here, I've been there. And I thought, well, great, that's nice, because I actually see you doing something. It might not be the best of everybody what they want you to achieve, but at least you can see you're active and you're working with the community, and that is what you expect out of people that are officers in town council, county council, or even an MP. They're just levels of access and accountability. That's all they mean to me in that part, and doing the job properly. The issue is that we have a government that seem to enjoy themselves. It's a big boys club. They've never done a hard day's work in their life, these people. They have no realisation of what it means of hardship. I've spoken to people that are well off when they say they have hardship. You know what that means? I get 6 bottles in my crate when it's delivered, not 12. That's their level of hardship. They're not foregoing things. You walk around some of the estates and you ask people how they are with their life. They are foregoing things. Their cars are not being renewed. They're not taking holidays as such. They're taking breaks. They're going to visit family. They're doing other things to make up those that actually have the capability of doing that. RSPCA, for example, the number of cases of pets being abandoned, animal cruelty is on the all-time high. And let's take a look at the children. The recent figures from the statistics across the board of welfare of children, children going into care is absolutely horrific. When you really sit down and take a look at that, the number of cases, the number of children being lost, the recent figures,
including
the Prime Minister's, there you are. What happened to all this security team that's supposed to keep an eye on the baby? That's just newspaper hogwash, isn't it, really?
Okay, well, anyway, at least the government is coming up with something. That is to say, King Mervyn from the Bank of England and George Osborne today, in fact last night, announced a £140 billion injection for businesses via the banks. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what do you make of this? This sounds great on the surface, doesn't it? £140 billion new pounds from the Bank of England for cheap loans to businesses to stop the double dip recession kicking in, but it's going via the banks again. So is it going to actually get through the banks, which seem to be like a black hole sucking this quantitative easing in over the last few years?
The answer to that is no, of course. It's doing the same thing again as we've been doing for the last 4 years, and presuming that the outcome is going to be any different. It's actually an admission of failure by the government, because if you're printing money to prop the banks up, and the banks are saying, well, the problem is not that we don't want to lend money, there's nothing to lend money to because there's no demand in the economy. Oh, well, that would be the other side of our policy of cuts, which you've just been pointing out. So we're taking real money out of the economy in terms of not employing a poo collector, and then because the economy starts to go down, we give some more money to the banks in the hopes that they will decide to set up a poo collectors cooperative and fund them. But of course, there's no demand for that to happen, because it's the government that actually is the final demand in the economy, in a modern economy. This isn't the 19th century, it's the 21st century. The government is a very important part of the economy, even for the private sector. 80% of government expenditure goes directly to private companies.
Ed Rose, you used to be Conservative, now, as of a couple of weeks ago, now UKIP councillor for Woodlands in Bradley Stoke. What's your thoughts about this new £140 billion?
This is a U-turn by the government. When the first signs of the recession were in, they wouldn't do this. They felt it was a failing, as you pointed out already. They were quite clear about that. We're not going to do that. We're not going to drag down that area. And what do we see them doing? Printing more money. If we go back in time, anybody that's printed more money have just brought more woes and trouble on. The interesting thing about the credit is that you take a look. Let's take an example at the lower level. If I'm struggling, I should be able to go to my bank, and let's go to the banks that were being bailed out by the government, or you and I through our taxes, in a sense, and say, right, well, I would like to start my own business. This is a big push. You know, don't be unemployed. Go and start your own business. Great, jolly well done. We give you tax credits and all the help you need. You go to the bank. The bank looks at you and says, oh, well, you're rubbish. You don't meet our score. I'm not going to give you any money. I'm not going to give you any chances. I don't care that you've got a home. I don't care you've got a car. I don't care you've got Krugerrands in there. Whatever it is, we're not going to give you any money. So there is absolutely no giving by the banks to the general public to get up and go. Then you take a look at what happens. The banks are upset because they can only get 28% out of you. Look at Wonga.com and look at all these other things. All right, who created those companies? The banks. The banks created those companies because the very money that they stole from the government, that they kept, can now be lent to people who are in a depression and need the money at 3,000%. Now, if you went to the Russian mafia, they only charged you 100%, and people complained in those days when they did that. You've got these companies that are tied to the banks underneath through those dirty backdoor dealings that they've all been in, that funded these companies, start them up, and they could take you that. There should be regulation that turns around and say, I'm sorry, but if the Bank of England says the loan rate is that much money and you're a company lending money, you cannot exceed that rate. Yes, you could be in competition with the bank, but you shouldn't be doing it at 3,000%. And say, oh, I'm only lending it you for 7 days.
Martin, where's this all heading anyway?
Well, it's all not looking good. I mean, I have to say that I agree with everything that you're saying, and I don't know why you've joined UKIP. You should have joined the Labour Party. I also agree with what you were saying about the electoral system, because that's what narrows it all down to the lowest common denominator. I think the real problem is not just what my economics tutors of years ago would say, what they're doing here is pushing on a string. The problem with the banks is not liquidity. They've got they're awash with money, and if I was a local bank manager of an old striper, Captain Mannering, I still wouldn't lend money to people because there's no demand. People have got good ideas for businesses, but if the 2,000 people have lost their jobs in Bradley Stoke in the last year, I'd say, well, where are your customers going to come from? And that's not being unreasonable as a local bank manager. The problem is there's no demand in the economy, which has been the problem all along. As Ed Ball said today, this is just, you know, I mean, he got lots of things wrong, but he's right about this. This is not going to solve the problem. It's ultimately you've got to use fiscal policy. It means government intervention. Sorry to
say. So what you're saying is, Martin,
Edward Heath in years gone by would not be cutting public expenditure at the moment. Absolutely.
Are you saying then, Martin, that the government should simply be spending this 140 billion into the economy?
Exactly. But the point is that the banks are bust. I only supported bail. A free market policy is followed by the von Mises Institute, for example. Proper free market policies let them go down. Never mind bailing them out. But of course, the consequences of that could be quite dire, and certainly a lot of rich people would lose money. So, hang on, we've got to be bailed out. Okay, I agreed with the bail acts. I understood that what we're effectively doing is nationalising the system, and they're going to be given their marching orders. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do that. But no, they didn't do that. They gave them the money and said, go on, try and reinvent yourselves as a private banking setup. But of course, they can't do that. It's a fantasy. And ultimately, when the banks crash, as they will, probably as a result of Greece's vote on Sunday, because that will then have a knock-on effect, only then will people realise the mess we're in. 2,000 jobs since last July in Bradley Stoke. When the banks crash, it's going to be everybody. And that's Bradley Stoke, which is one of the most successful districts in the country. Just think how it's going to play out in Middlesbrough. And at that point, I think the government will implode, especially as the debt of the government debt will increase, as we've seen in Spain. They've been given this big bailout, but it's had to go through the Spanish government's books, so it's actually the taxpayers are on the hook for it. And that, of course, basically is just socialising losses and privatising profits. And I'm glad to hear the common sense that I've heard from you this afternoon, because this used to be mainstream conservative talk, that we don't believe in super free market capitalism. We're conservatives. We believe in a balanced, mixed economy. We haven't heard that kind of talk for a generation, have we?
Ed, you're talking then about regulation, toughening up regulation. We don't have a very tough regulator with the Financial Services Authority, largely because they're funded by the banks. What would you like to see then as regards the economy? If we start off with actually enforcing existing regulations, what else would you like to see if you were in the shoes of George Osborne?
I would like to see that you have the mechanism of dealing with the banks tightened up. It doesn't really need reform. If we step back 30 years, it worked, and it was there, and the banks didn't behave in the manner they behave now. Banks were called to the minister's office and were spoken, not to, but with, about the way things would happen, and they had the respect of working with the economy.
But how do you actually go from here? Because hearing from Martin is that these banks, because of the massive investment in derivatives, are actually insolvent right now.
Well, it's all paper money. Every country's insolvent. Even China is really insolvent, because if you take a look at the books, everybody's borrowed everyone's out of everyone's pocket.
So there's not enough money in the system to pay back all the debts, essentially.
There's not enough money in the system. What it is that there's not enough real bargaining chips in the system, and there hasn't been for a long time. The aspect is you try to drive an economy forward and push it forward in a sense of consumerism. That hasn't worked. And the aspect that's gone on is that every government in Europe and still continue to behave like a wayward teenager. Dear Dad, I've gone out, spent all my pocket money, I'm sorry, I'm out of money, give me some more. I want this, I want that. And stupidly, we're giving in to Europe and we're paying out that money. That's the point where UKIP stands on Europe. We have to get out of Europe because basically we're being bled dry. We're paying a membership fee, and then its secret is to exactly how much money else that Britain's paying out for crazy ideas that's going on in Europe. Their accounting in Europe hasn't been audited for 9.5 years, if I'm right. So you tell me, if I went to my bank and said, well, excuse me, Mr. Bank Manager, or Madam Bank Manager, I'd like £1 million, please, because I have this wonderful idea that I'm going to go do something, which I don't really have to explain to you, but because I'm in Europe, you just give it to me, give me the money. And they just hand it out. I wish I was in that queue, don't you? I mean, I think as a European citizen, I would like to go along and say, well, just give me some money, or change my VAT.
Sounds to me like it's quite a lot of fraud going on if they're not prepared to have their accounts audited.
Oh, it is
fraud.
The other thing is
that the three main auditing companies in Britain, I remember hearing over Christmas, during the Christmas holidays, that the Competition Commission is now investigating them. So it does sound like that there's some real problems with the actual balance sheets that these companies are coming back with.
It's called creative accounting, or when you speak to the people over a beer or a whiskey, it's called fudging the numbers. And they fudge the numbers so much that they fudge the fudge. And so because it's so hot in there, it's melted it and it's burnt to the tin. So when you look at it, what do you do? You have to throw the tin away. And that's the picture that we're dealing with. And the fact of the matter is, because they're in league with Cameron in the government, they turn around and say there is no accountability. And this is the bit that I came to earlier, where I hinted on the fact that I think they should bring in the fact of treason. What they need to do is put all the bankers in there and other people that behave in that disgusting manner, if we can do what we like and threaten the stability of the state and the sovereign, for that matter, in the way that they behave. Let's go on to Murdoch. Let me throw Murdoch in there, that with that arrogance in the way they behave, and think they can bully people around and control this and control that. They should be pulled in and told, no, there's certain things that the government of this country, for the well-being of this country, won't stand for. And if you cross that line, that is the aspect that you will face.
But Ed, surely so many people have crossed that line already that it's almost impossible to do anything about it.
Well, no, it isn't. It isn't. You turn around and you get a hold of wayward people, you turn and say, I'm sorry, I'm bringing law and order in. We may have, because of what's gone on before, say that, but from now on you don't step over that line. You step over that line again now, and this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, but which is more powerful, the power of money, economic determinism, or law and order?
Law and order.
Well, let's hope so. We're joined by Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. News from the Bristol City Council. Bristol City Council is consulting the public, asking for opinions on how it should spend £12.5 million in the next year commissioning drugs and alcohol rehabilitation. It has also published a draft strategy for the period 2012-2015 based on research into changing trends of drugs use and the opinions of services users. When complete, this will set the council's priorities and strategic direction for the next 3 to 5 years. The report recommends, the first, making services more widely available across Bristol, not just the city centre, more joint working between partners agencies to help drug users with complex needs, such as those mental health problems, and third, creating a more flexible service to reflect change in drug trends. Comments can be emailed to max.harris@bristol.gov.uk and telephone number 0117 914 2207, or completed online before the proposed deadlines of 17th of August 2012. The results are expected by 28th of September and feedbacks expected by 12th of October 2012. Drug addiction is a major driver of crime within the city and links into other areas of concern such as career support, disability, health service and facilities, mental health, social service and social care, the criminal justice system, homelessness and housing. Many of the council's existing services will be put out to competitive tendering with new contracts applying from November 2013. A number of public consultation events are to be held throughout the city. The next is the Gatehouse Center, south in the Highcliffe Road, Bristol, BS 13, 9 GM, Thursday, 21st of June 2012, between 12 and 4 p.m. Rehabilitation regimes are long-term, high-cost, and often unsuccessful. The quick low-cost wins are in education, protecting tomorrow's citizens from addiction. But to focus solely on education is to consign today's addicts to the scrap heap. How do we best help these vulnerable people back on the road towards recovery with limited financial resources and motivate them towards positive life change?
Thanks, Marina. Well, Ed Rose from Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor, what do you make of this? Because it seems like the drug rehabilitation services are being sort of farmed out, just as many of their other public services have been. Do you think it's this is a good service to be tendered out to the private sector?
I haven't seen the paperwork on this, so it's a bit of an easy question looking for a hard answer to say is this good or not. I don't know how it operates. I think that's better placed if someone actually works in that department or in that sector that would actually know how it's been taken care of at the moment. I think the thing is that we all agree that anybody that comes into drugs and has a problem, it is an uphill struggle to deal with the generalisation of life, to deal with recovery, to deal with mental health issues.
How do you actually address these problems at the root? What's the root of the problem? I mean, if you could just wave your magic wand and sort one kind of aspect of society out, why is it, do you think, people get into drugs, which can help them be self-destructive in the first place?
Well, I think you put the clue in there, self-destructive. It's the point that I don't want to face reality, let me take drugs and I feel good about myself. It's that stepping away into Lucy the Sky with Diamonds.
So how do we make people's realities a bit better so they don't feel the need for escapism?
Well, the reality of making it a bit better is that you have a level of quality of life whereby you have education, you have a future, you have a possible job. You get focused on that. I speak to a lot of youth in various areas. They're asking questions about the fact of, well, what is there for me? I go to school at the moment, you know, I'm finishing sixth form or I'm going to go to university, and already the last two groups that have come out of university, I call them in different groups because they fit into different sectors of where they are, some fare better than others, don't have employment. And they're thinking, what do I do? Where do I go? The good old standbys that you used to have in my day when that issue was facing myself in the 70s was, well, you went to work in the post office, you went to work in the local shop, or, God forbid, you went to the military services because that was the last end of it all, that there was always a job there. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. That's all long gone. Our economy is so stretched with people trying to make ends meet that you have people that should be retired and enjoying their life. They're taking jobs because they need it just to keep their heads above water. You've got families that are struggling, so everybody's trying to work where they can. And the way that companies are behaving with them, they're making people work longer hours, they're taking away all their benefits, they're making them work as agency workers. So all these agencies take the profit of £14 an hour and pay those people £6, 9p an hour. There's no healthcare, there's no pension, there's no holiday, and you're sacked on a moment's notice. Well, they don't call it sack anymore, they just say, well, you know, the need for your requirement is gone. So when you talk to people that have the will that they want to get up and they want to get work and they want to have a good life, it just doesn't exist at this level. And that's again what the government doesn't understand. They quite happily go around and privatise everything because it's easy to do. We have the story here about the staff working at the Jubilee. Well, we'll just rope anybody together, we'll get them in, pay them minimum wage, you know, they'll be grateful, give them a few breadcrumbs.
Well, Downing Street stepped in, didn't they, and they said that this was a one-off. This particular company, CPUK, Close Protection UK, and as it happens, there's also another story in the Independent this week, saying that the pageant fiasco, now the minibus carrying Close Protection UK staff overturns on the M40. The security company at the centre of a row about its treatment of unpaid workers is facing fresh questions last night after a minibus carrying 15 of its stewards overturned on a motorway and its driver was arrested on suspicion of dangerous driving. There was also questions over whether they were actually allowed to drive that minibus and whether there was a proper insurance in place. So it was almost a tempting fate for Downing Street to say this was a one-off. Martin?
Well, I agree with that, what you've just said, Tony, and I obviously agree with what's just been said. I think also we have an organisation in Bristol, which I work with reasonably closely, called Transform, who are campaigning for the legalisation of all drugs. Because, well, the problem we've got at the moment is the money involved is enormous. And if you look at Mexico, where 40,000 people have died in drug-related violence in the last 3 years, Latin American presidents of all political persuasions are saying, look, we've just got to face up to this and legalise these drugs. And then, of course, that doesn't get around the problems of addiction and so on and so forth. But we saw that with prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s in the US. Making things illegal creates a huge illegal market. And that illegal market then becomes the source of fraud and corruption. There was a UN report on drugs and crime that came out a year after the banking crisis, and it said, well, you know what happened to all the dirty money in the system, all around, all the money under mattresses and so on. The drug cartels went to the banks and said, hey, you guys are having a panic, you haven't got any money, have you? Said, we've got some, would you like it? And they took it in. The whole thing was sucked in, all the dirty money sucked into the system just like that. And meanwhile, we're arresting teenagers for smoking a joint. Meanwhile, the banking system is being propped up by the taxpayer and the drug cartels, and that's the reality. Without the drug cartels and the taxpayer, all the banks would be bust.
Well, I mean, I always remember the film, the black and white Humphrey Bogart film, Key Largo, which is actually about not about drugs, but about the old US alcohol prohibition days, where the only thing that gets this gangster rattled is when they start talking about ending prohibition, because of course the prohibition of alcohol actually fueled massive growth in the mafia in the United States.
Your modern drugs trade is much bigger than that. Massive.
It's an octopus. It's organized. An international crime syndicate that are linked up.
Well, they also work closely with subverting law and order and intelligence agencies and so on.
Now,
intelligence agencies—they've been in it for years.
They're about half the people who make it.
Exactly. So, but if we've got the CIA, who are documented big drug dealers, I think we've reached the point where we've got to talk about legalisation, because these people are paid by the taxpayer to run drugs.
Okay, and
I know what went on in the 1980s with the Iran-Contra affair. The understory of that was exactly that.
Okay, on a completely unrelated topic, Rupert Murdoch and David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has been at the Leveson inquiry yesterday. Let's see what he had to say. But first, a couple of clips. First, about how often he met up with the now charged with perverting the course of justice ex-editor of The Sun, Rebecca Brooks.
It's very difficult because I don't have a record and I don't want to give you an answer that isn't right. So,
when you're at your constituency at weekends,
yes,
I mean, did you see her every weekend or most weekends at the period 2008-2009?
I think not every weekend.
But most weekends?
In 2008-2009, I'd have to check. I might be able to, you know, go back and check, but I don't think every weekend. I don't think most weekends, but it would depend.
Well, it starts to become a bit clearer, maybe, why the breaches of the ministerial code by Jeremy Hunt aren't really being addressed at the moment. It sounds like David Cameron is a little bit nervous there about admitting to the irregularity with which, before the general election, Martin, he was meeting up with Rebecca, who was actually a very close neighbour of his.
Well, yes. I mean, I think most people are not necessarily following this as closely as news anoraks like ourselves. But of course it all begins to create a smell, doesn't it, that the government has in fact been, you know, it's crony capitalism, crony government, isn't it? And once the general perception is that that's what's going on, I think the government will gradually disintegrate.
And from one alleged criminal, Rebecca Brooks, to another alleged criminal, this time Andy Coulson, also the editor of, in fact, the News of the World. This is what David Cameron was responded to when he was questioned about why he employed Andy Coulson. This is just before the general election as the head of communications for the Conservative Party.
There do seem to be some differences, but they may well be compatible in the way that I've suggested. But anyway, I'm certain I sought the assurances. He's certain I sought the assurances. He just says it happened at a different time. The key thing is, I asked for assurances, I got them, and that was the basis on which I employed him.
Well, Ed, as David Cameron saying, he's got assurances from Andy Coulson that he wasn't involved in the phone hacking.
Great. It's like talking to your best friend and saying, well, what do you think of that? And he tells you one thing to the public, to your mum, and he tells you something different. It's all hogwash. They're all in the dirt in this. The whole fact of the matter is that they've called the number of politicians in, ex-prime ministers in, to talk about this, how far it reaches back. You've had inter-cooperation with the Murdoch Empire by the government. There's been money exchange hands there somewhere along the line for what was going on.
Well, we've also had several arrests of public officials this week, haven't we?
Well, we've had arrests that's going on. The matter stinks to high heaven all the way across the board. You've got other people that's hiding out in America. You know, you've got Piers Morgan, for example. He was involved in hacking. He knew about it. You're telling me that anyone that runs an operation speaks to the staff and say, where did that story come from? Oh, I'm not telling you, but I've got this juicy information. You're telling me they didn't know where they were getting information from and how they were finding it and how they were putting it together. They all knew. They were told by Murdoch that this is the way I want it, and this is the way it's going to be, and that's how it is. Why is it that the fact that certain people that have been involved in this have been arrested and charged and let go, other people have been arrested and are helping with inquiries, and yet the whole Murdoch family, really, when this blew up, should have been arrested, arraigned, charged, and thrown in jail? But they're allowed to come back and say, well, we'll talk about it for the next 7 years, and the only people making money out of this are the lawyers.
So what are your thoughts about the whole Leveson process? It's a bit bizarre. It was almost Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, when after lunch yesterday, David Cameron's wife apparently had phoned in and told him how often he'd met Rebecca Brooks.
Unfortunately, this country is going down the pathway of being like a mini America. Let's have a big old get together. Let's have a big old conference about it, and we'll all get in there, and we'll all have our chance to say something, and we'll all fuff and flaff. It should be done in 10 minutes. Should be pulled in, put on there and said, did you or did you not do this? A simple yes or no is all that's required.
Martin, we also heard yesterday the text from Rebecca Brooks to David Cameron. One text released. I'd rather think it would be interesting to know about all the other texts that changed hands. This is one to saying that, you know, we're all in this together. Mm. So why is it? It's very selective, isn't it, what we're hearing?
Well, yes, because the big fish are being protected and the small fish are being thrown to the sharks. But the small fish being thrown to the sharks then have an incentive to grass up their bosses, don't they? So it's still washing around their ankles, isn't it? All of this messy stuff. The stuff that was kicked into the stream that you were talking about in Bradley's Stoke.
OK, well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, UKIP councillor for Woodlands and Bradley Stoke, Ed Rose. After the news, railways and much more.